Hello, Sorisete, to our 14th symposia. In any case, it's wonderful to have so many people and so many return visitors and new people tonight. And so I'm just going to go for the new people, just talk a little bit about the symposia. Sin pino is to drink together. So a Greek would never consider drinking without food. So basically the idea of symposia is a dining experience with food heightened by wine. And so when they would call a symposia, they would send invitations out. They would note that it would be a political or a cultural event so people could come ready to spar or ready to just relax and have a good time. Tonight, we're having a good time. Thank you, Jim. Tonight, we're having a cultural experience. Very happy to have Jim here tonight and his wife, Diane Wilson, I should say. We've started with, we have a lot of vegetarian and seafood-free folks tonight. So we've done yigindis, which are vegan. We have the scallops. Those are sauteed with a little anchovy sauce and ouzo, and then put on a bed of endive with a little bit of fresh ground red peppercorn. Red peppercorn, you may or may not know, is the immature black peppercorn. So before, and in Greece, they hang off the boughs everywhere, and they're wonderful. So when you crush them, they have a bit of a fruity bite to them. And so that's what was on the scallops. And then we have the maitake mushrooms, which are considered forest mushrooms, and they're very, very healthful and anti-carcinogenic, supposedly. So I'm very happy to provide that every time. And I got the last half case, so I was thrilled to get that.
Excellent.
And that was with a little wine and lemon sauce and olive oil and rosemary. So that was our first course, and we accompanied that with the Asprolithi, which is a dry minerally white. And for anybody who wanted Retsina, we have the Lafkiote Retsina, which is one of our favorite Retsinas and remind us of our summers in Greece. And now I'm going to go back and prepare the second course, and we're going to accompany that with a Kleoni Rosé. Kleoni is from ancient Kleoni, northern Peloponnesos. They've been doing it for a very long time, and it's a very dry rosé. A lot of people have bad opinions about rosés. Greeks do rosés very, very well. They're usually dry, full body, very nicely structured, and with a clean finish, no cloying. So this we have paired with the golden beet and fennel and leek soup, which is a very light broth with a little bit of sherry in the base. And we're gonna serve it with Cretan rusks with a coriander olive mash. And so that's on top. So you can break that off and put it in the soup and thicken it up, or you can dip it, you can have it just accompanying however you like. And so now is my pleasure to introduce Jim, and I'm gonna help Danomi, right? Okay, so let's give a hand of applause to Jim. Come on.
Well, first of all, I wanna thank everybody for coming tonight. That's, I think it's quite an honor to be part of this. This is such a great establishment, and the food is delicious. The ambiance, wow, look at this. Look at the art around here.
Oh, check it out.
Yes. I wanted to just give some background. I'm Ojibwe. I was born in northern Wisconsin in a small town just outside of my reservation, which is called Lacouture. And that was 1955. When I was about 4 years old, my mother and father moved me and my two brothers to Chicago as part of the Relocation Act, which was a government program to move Native Americans off the reservation and integrate into the larger society in an attempt to do away with reservations. And it was one of a number of programs that the government has come up with over the years to try to distinguish Native American identity and the reservation system. So after about a year, my mother and father separated, divorced, and we moved to Minneapolis with my two brothers and my mother. And we joined some other family who had already moved to South Minneapolis, and which has become one of the larger urban Native American communities in the country. And so we were distant from the reservation. I grew up in South Minneapolis, pretty much a brown American. My grandparents were products of the boarding school system, and so they did not teach everything to my parents, who therefore had less to teach me and my brothers. So I grew up not knowing a whole lot about my cultural heritage, but we still go back to the reservation every summer, winter breaks, many times throughout the year for family events and gatherings. But I grew up in Minneapolis, just being an American, pretty much. And so I started doing art. I knew I was interested in being an artist since I was probably 5-6 years old. One of my first art lessons was a cousin who lived with us. She was about 5 years older than me. She set up a still life on a kitchen table when I was about 7 years old. And it was cereal boxes and pots and pans. And we just did pencil drawings. She showed me how to do some shading and toning. And that was my first art lesson. And I eagerly participated in art whenever it was offered in school. And when I got to Minneapolis South High, 1971, there was a 2-year experiment with modular scheduling, which is meant to prepare high school students for college. And so there was a lot of free time. You had mods where you were scheduled to be in class, and you had a lot of free time. You were expected to organize your time, self-discipline yourself to study and use this time wisely. Well, 16 years old in South Minneapolis, we were getting high and pitching coins against the wall and cruising. But the art room was always open, and as long as there wasn't a class scheduled, you could go into the supply room and grab a canvas board and paint and start painting. And so I found myself spending more time doing that and not making it to my other classes. And I went to see my high school counselor and asked if I could transfer to a school where I could focus on art, because I said, I'm not going to succeed in this format. And she says, no, you don't want to do that. There's no future. There's no money in it. It's a terrible choice. And I said, it's either that or I drop out of school. And so I ended up dropping out of school, 16 years old, getting into a full-time minimum wage job and into a lifestyle of partying and addictions for the next 20 years. And I gave up art. And so I was able to get into construction later and start making a decent living. And I was married and divorced after 10 years and I had 2 daughters. And every once in a while, I would think back with resentment towards this counselor, and I wonder where I'd be today if she had supported my desire to go to art school. But 1989, I finally got sober, made it through the other side of my alcoholism, and got healthy again. 1990, I enrolled in the University of Minnesota, hoping to get out of construction and into the health sciences. But I ended up taking some art classes, and I also became involved with the Native American community on campus. And both these things just turned me in a whole different direction. So then in 1995, I graduated with my Bachelor of Fine Arts degree and a minor in American Indian Studies, and I started to make art. And since my very first show, I've enjoyed lots of compliments and recognition. I have found that one opportunity has led to 2 more. And so I've met lots of supporters and gotten lots of encouragement to continue. I never really sold a lot. When I graduated, I went back into drywall. And this time it was a vehicle that allowed me to paint what I wanted to paint and not necessarily what was going to sell. And so I was able to experiment more and come up with more challenging imagery. And it was this type of imagery that got me invited into more shows. And I just kept growing and kept developing my artwork. And so later in my slideshow, I've picked a bunch of slides that will show this journey that I've been on.
So, you know, it's all kind of segueing and exploding, and I'm really happy to have this kind of a group, because I believe that food is something that brings people together, and food is something in which we have in common. And I hope that we're just kind of elevating life a little bit here tonight. And, you know, like forgetting about that out there, and that's good. So we are doing the third course now, Let's see, I want to say something about, where did I get something? The maitake mushrooms, I had a couple questions with that. They're also known as hen of the woods, and I'm always harassing the Southeast Food Network. It's like, Renee, when are we going to get the hen of the woods? You know, so, and this year I gave her a whole list of fennel and endive and fava beans. I'm always trying to help these farmers create things that I like to cook with, because it's very hard to go to the farmer's market every week and haul enough food for the restaurant. So we're working with different food producers around the state. And the other one is Garden Farm, and they are going to do our Scarlet Runner beans, which I'm very excited about. That's going to be part of our next symposia. So we're doing things that are a little heirloom and a little bit, you know, searching the archives of what Greeks would eat and what they ate in antiquity. So the maitake mushroom is called Hen of the Woods, and it grows on a log, and it grows after wet rain. So, and they burst up suddenly, and literally when I get them from the Southeast Food Network, they're like this big, and they look like brown chickens, and they're just kind of fluttering. It's just beautiful. Now these are cultivated, and it was the last season. Apparently they'd only do it November and December and January, and I got the last, as I said. So I was very happy because I didn't think about it this year, but I was looking for something a little bit different, and I was very happy to get that. So I hope you enjoy that. We are going now into the main course, and the main course is cunelli stifado. Now, once we were on the way to church at 12 o'clock midnight, and there was a little bunny that was in the gutter, and a cat was coming down, and we stopped, and we grabbed the bunny, and we kept the bunny, and we had it for Greek Easter, and everybody asked us the name of the little bunny that we'd saved, and it was stifado, because and it was kind of a joke, so I always start this one with this joke, because stifado is a stewed rabbit with onion. It's like saying fricassee, you know? Stifado is a type of cooking. Basically what it is, it's browned meat, and could be anything besides rabbit. This is domestic rabbit. We haven't been shooting anybody's bunnies. and it's with a varietal of, you know, red and green and crimson shallots, which are all peeled and cut. We brown them up, and we simmer them in wine and spices. And so it's just kind of melty and delicious. So there is one wine that has almost been in every course, and you'll find it, I mean, it's actually in every course, and it's called Mavro Daphne, and it is a sweet red wine, and it has informed the scallops, and it's in the it's in both the rabbit as well as the turkey. Now the turkey, I had turkey many years ago, first time at student housing at a Greek house, and first of all they brought up this big roasting pan with chunks of meat, and I was like, well, where's the turkey, you know, because we have these beautiful big whole presentations. But no, this was all hacked up, and it was with fruit and wine. It was very dark. There was nothing really white about it. And so this is what I tried to recreate tonight. A lot of Mavro Daphne with plums and craisins and currants from Zante, that's Zankynthos. That's literally the island of Greece. So it's going to be kind of a counterpoint. We're going to have like the really zesty, rabbit, and the kind of fruity turkey. So, and it's going to be served on a big mash of potatoes, which are vegan, if anybody's... We'll make that available to those who are not eating meat tonight. And we're going to do it with the Nausa wine. Nausa is a Xino Mavro. It's a single berry grape varietal. And it is from northern Greece, north central Greece. And the town is actually called Nausa. So that's where the wine comes from. And I think it will be a nice stand-up wine to the two entrees. And I hope you enjoy it. And now we're going to, while I go and prepare that, Jim is going to show us his slide presentation.
When I started taking painting classes at the U of M, I was struggling with the voice, trying to find my own voice. And one of my painting instructors, David Feinberg, who's a good friend of mine today, he looked at my sketchbook and he said, why don't you just start painting these sketches, one every class period? And so this was one of the sketches in my sketchbook. It was a self-portrait I did. Earlier while I was a student there, and but as I started to paint, then I started to add all these different symbolisms in there. My sketch did not have a box of macaroni and cheese in my pocket, but as you paint, things come to you. And for me, it's storytelling, and things come to me. And I've learned that while I do some of these paintings, I rely on my memory, my imagination, and also I learn things. Unexpected things happen or enter my mind while I'm working these things. This painting is called Sustenance, and it's about things that feed me.
So what is with a nude girl going down?
That's right. There's a nude girl skiing into a slice of bread.
Wonder bread.
It represents, to me, it represents the women in my life, from my partners to my mother to my daughters. This painting is called Misfortunes, and it's about Columbus coming and then leaving behind an influence, and these six women are telling a story with their body language. And on the beach is a slot machine, and it represents casinos. This painting, I did this in 1994, and casinos were a relatively new event in the Native community, or Minnesota for that matter. On the slot wheels is a condom, a red cross, and a martini glass, and it represents disease, alcohol, and religion, which came along with the Europeans. And so these women are the first two are welcoming these events, casinos and Columbus, and the next one is realization that they're not what they seem to be. And the next two are saying farewell, and the last one is wisdom and retrospect. Next. This painting is called the... Oh, sure. There you go. See, I love questions. This painting, I saw this in my mind when I went back to the U of M. I started to learn history that's not available to you in the public school system. And so I, like a lot of people, didn't understand how the reservation system developed in this country. And when I started to read about it and learn it, I saw this visually. And so I saw the reservation as metaphorically as these tall mesa tops and confinement, and then flight becoming an issue of privilege and who controls it. So this is called The Renegade, and the cavalry is chasing the last winged warrior. When he catches them, they will all be confined to the tops of these mesas, leaving access to the water and the minerals below to the people who have the privilege of flight. Next. And so this became a great way to tell stories about social, political issues involving the Native community. This is called Irony. It's about Native Americans celebrating Christmas and the birth of Christianity. And I thought, boy, how ironic is that? I did about 13 or 14 paintings in the Renegade series. This one, I got the inspiration for this when I got a craving for chicken one day. And I realized that, you know, the Native Americans are not living off the buffalo, but thanks to movies like Dances with Wolves, a lot of people still see us in that nostalgic, romantic notion. And so there's also been this image of Indians hunting the buffalo. It's been done over and over and over again. And so this is playing on that image. And I decided to recreate the buffalo as this huge chicken, and all the Indians are hunting with golf clubs. I love the golf, and so I start to put things about me into these paintings.
What's the significance of the Volkswagen?
What's that?
The Volkswagen Beetle.
Somebody just asked about what's the significance of the Volkswagen Beetle in here. Well, two things. I had just met my wife right now. We had started dating about the time I did this painting, and we started to play the slug bug game. And the other thing, it represents, the title of this painting is called Transitions, and it's about Native people moving into the 20th century yet maintaining cultural identity. And the European, or the Volkswagen, represents European influence and assimilation.
What's that in the front?
Oh, that's a golf club flying out. It's
a driver.
It just flew over the chicken, and now it's coming right out of the painting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's number one.
No, it's a four. It's a driver. Yeah, and the Indian on the horse in the right-hand corner kind of looks like the colonel. Okay, let's go to the next one. In 1997, I was invited to participate in an erotica show by a good friend of mine, Al Wadzinski. And I didn't have anything that specifically pertained to this subject matter. And so I started just to play with my sketches, and I came up with this image. And it just opened up a new series for me. And it's simply just titled Erotic Landscape. But it was an image I played with for a while. Next. And the compositions grew and became more complex. And I found that these were kind of a contrast to renegade paintings, where those were literal conscious stories. And these were more intuitive and not conscious. And so I was just working more off of feeling and color and mood. Okay. Let's see, and then about 2001, I got a grant to go up to the North Shore to do an artist residency. And I rented a cabin just north of Grand Marais for 2 weeks. And I went up, I brought several canvases and sketchbooks, and I had specific ideas that I wanted to work on. But when I got there, things happened that I didn't expect. Really cool dreams, and I came up with this concept to combine the renegade landscape with the erotic landscape, and then the rabbit appeared, and so a new genre developed called Dream Rabbit. And I didn't know at the time what these were about, but later I come to realize that they were about my own fears and desires, and they were more emotional landscapes. And I usually, when I work on a painting, I usually put something in. Well, everything around you affects your work, whatever's going on in your life. And up in the upper right-hand tree in that branch, there's a double bird figure. At the time, there was a house fire, and my sister's partner and their son died in this fire. And so I acknowledged them with that icon. 2005, I challenged myself to do at least one painting every day for a year. And I did so because we had just moved into our place a couple years before, and I spent 7 months building our studios, and I didn't get a whole lot of work done that year. And then I remembered a visiting artist when I was in art school who showed slides of his work, and one was a slide of a bookshelf full of sketchbooks. And he explains that he does a sketch every day of his life. And it's a good way of documenting things and then conjuring up something new and unexpected. And so I remembered that, and I thought, well, I can try to challenge myself to do that for a year. And so I did. 2005, I did at least one painting every day for a year. I wound up doing 430 paintings for the year. Some days I did two or three. Some days I did larger. Most were 5x7, 8x10s. And most were portraits. Portraiture was never really a serious subject matter for me, but when I did this painting a day, I found that the portrait wasn't the subject matter, that the painting and the color and the brushstroke was the subject matter, and the portrait became the form. So I did a number of portraits. Next. The previous one was called Medicine Man. Most of these are untitled, but if I recognize something in them, then I gave them a title. This is simply Man and Woman. Next. During 2005, a lot of big events happened that year. One was the Red Lake school shooting. Katrina hurricane happened. I did several paintings in response to that. Some friends had passed on. This is called Bulletproof, and it was my reaction to the Red Lake school shooting. And I titled it Bulletproof because I saw this event similar to a tornado manifesting, that this was an unpreventable tragedy. That the shooter, Jeffrey Weiss, was just as much a victim in this as the seven other people that he shot and killed. This is called, I have a friend, I did a show up at the Duluth Art Institute, and the director, John Steffel, became a good friend of mine and supporter. And in 2005, he was being treated for a stomach cancer. And he's actually the impetus for doing these portraits. As I was talking to him in September, October of 2004, and he wasn't doing good then. He was still going through his chemo treatments and wasn't feeling good. And after we got done talking, I did this greenish portrait of somebody, and I couldn't tell if it was him or me. I mean, I felt bad too. So when I started my painting a day, well, I started to make portraits for some Christmas presents, but that was actually the beginning of my portrait endeavors. And so I went up to show him some of these new portraits that were developing, and this is the only painting out of that 430 that I did with a palette knife. And he picked it up and he said, "This is how I feel when I'm on chemo." And I said, "Well, then this one's yours. I'm going to title it Chemo Sabi." Next. And so now I continue to do portraits. I don't do a painting a day, but I like doing portraits, small portraits, 8x10, 16x20s, as a way just to keep the brush moving, keep digging up things. This is called One More Mouth to Feed. Next. This is just another sample of portraits that developed out of this daily painting project. This is called War Chief. Well, you know, I don't set out to do a scary portrait or a funny one. I mean, but the end, they result in different meanings. In fact, I did. I thought when I did this painting, I thought that maybe I should tone it down. But then I said, nah, it's a strong painting. It's an honest painting. So I'm glad I didn't tone it down. This is a painting after dogs playing poker. Cribbage is big in the Indian community, and so this is where I learned to do math as a kid, was playing cribbage. And so I painted this after dogs playing poker. It's called Partners. And in the background is a big picture window with my truck and garage and studio in there. And over to the right is one of my Dream Rabbit painting landscapes. And on the TV is a golf game. I love watching golf. Next. This is another painting that's after some art history. It's after The Last Supper. It's called The Last Chicken. Over on the left-hand side, with my grandparents up on the reservation LCO, my father's parents and my mother's parents both lived there. And my father's parents were traditional. They spoke the language and harvested wild rice and still lived a lot of the traditional things. And on my mother's side, my grandmother was Christian. And my grandfather was somewhere in there. He wasn't Christian, but... So I remember that painting as a kid at my grandmother's house, The Last Supper. And so I put that in there. The painting next to it, the round one, was a painting at my other's grandfather. It was a photo of one of my cousins who went to Vietnam War and didn't come home. And over on the right is a painting of Elvis. Throughout my art career, I've had people encourage me and say things like, "Why don't you paint a good Indian painting, go to Santa Fe, you'd make a lot of money." And I thought to myself, well, if I'm going to just make a painting just to make money, I could be painting Elvis's on black velvet. Next. And I started to add these horse figures in along with these new portraits. And through this daily painting project, I learned a lot of things. A number of things came to me about just learning my materials better, my brushes, my inspiration, where that came from. And so I developed this new painting style, and it was something that I actively sought. Before I started my painting project, I looked at paint books of artists that I wanted to emulate, and most of those were expressionistic, like Joan Mitchell, Nathan Oliveira, Elmer Bischoff. And so I told myself that this project was going to be about going back to junior high art classes where you just have fun and experiment and explore, and you don't worry about a destination or a level that these all had to hit. And so I was able to develop a more expressionistic painting style and imagery. And so I started to take some of this imagery that developed and brought it back to my more narrative work. This is called Coochie and Tuffy, and Coochie was my cousin's nickname. We had all kinds of weird names up on the reservation. Coochie, Shreeb, Bumps, Puddin'. And Tuffy was our wiener dog who was up on the reservation. And Tuffy has made it into a number of my paintings too. Next. This painting is called The Procession. And my sister was being treated for cardiomyopathy for about 4 years, and she was in and out of the hospital. And one night she had a very tough night, wasn't expected to survive. We were all camped in the waiting room all night long. In the morning, doctor came out and said her numbers rose dramatically, and everybody went home hopeful. And I went home and painted two paintings, and this was one of them. Next. When I was in art school, I had a hard time finding support for the work I was doing. I was doing storytelling, and it wasn't clearly understood, and therefore it wasn't supported so well. In fact, one of my instructors said, "You know what your problem is? You think too much." And I thought, well, that's true. These symbols mean something. I'm thinking about what they mean and how to place them. And so I knew I wasn't getting any support from them, so I just tried to work off the figure as much as possible in class and just work on painting and visual language. And so when I got to my own studio, I still did figurative workshops with other artists, and then even in my studio. And so some of these paintings didn't hit. And so I hate wasting paint. And so when I get to the end of the palette and it's starting to get thick, I don't want to throw it away, so I go grab a painting that I'm not protecting and just would randomly throw this paint color around and scramble it up and then stand back and try to form it into something. And so this is a painting that I worked on for about 8 years and finally got it to a point where I liked it and I signed it and I quit. It's called End of the Trail. Next. This one here, I conceived this title while I was driving. I just started laughing my ass off. It's called Edward Curtis Paparazzi. And so I went home and I made a sketch of this. And I got to say, I always carry a sketchbook because you never know when an idea is going to come. And when I get free time, I get done working sometimes, or I have time in between and a meeting or something, I'll go to the coffee shop and sketch. And so I sketched this, and then I did this painting of it, and it was the start of several more paintings in that series. So on the gas tank of the motorcycle, it says hardly, and it means hardly accurate. And what's happening is Edward Curtis, who's really known for documenting Native culture, but he staged his photographs. He wanted to make sure that they were shot in their pure cultural identity. And so even though the railroad system was going on and automobiles were happening, he did not want to present any of that. And so I work in contrast to that. I show Native Americans in modern times. And so this really worked out to be a good... this is another one, Edward Curtis. It's called... Edward Curtis Paparazzi - Skinny Dip. And it's a play on Edward Manet's Luncheon in the Grass. My wife and I, we usually have a date night on Friday nights, and if we're not out at an art opening or a dinner symposium, we usually rent a movie and have a dinner and watch a movie. And on this night, I kind of stepped out of my body for a second. I looked at all of us sitting on the couch. We had one cat at the time and a dog, and I thought, well, this might make an interesting image. So after the movie was over, and I went out to my studio and I sketched a much not as detailed scene. It was just a very brief image. And then I did this painting of it, and it's called Remote. This is called A Beautiful Hero, Woody Keeble. And it's about a Dakota man, who was a veteran of World War II and the Korean War. And because of his heroics in the Korean War, he was recommended for the Medal of Honor twice. And both times his paperwork was mysteriously lost. And so I started reading about him about 7 years ago, about his family and some politicians in North and South Dakota who were petitioning Congress to posthumously award Woody Keeble the Congressional Medal of Honor. And so I started to read more and more. I started to research, and this man's heroics are just unbelievable. In this particular scene, his troop was charged with taking this mountaintop, which was heavily fortified by the Korean army with 3 machine gun bunkers and hundreds of infantrymen. And every time they charged, they were annihilated. And Woody Keeble, who was a minor league prospect as a baseball pitcher, he went up the mountain single-handedly one day, and single-handedly took out all 3 machine gun nests because he had a pitcher's arm. He could throw these hand grenades with distance and accuracy, and he shot 9 infantrymen and inspired his men, and they took the mountain. And so George Bush did award him the Medal of Honor about 5 years ago. So I had to do this painting about this man. He became my hero.
What's the owl about? Where is that?
Well, the owl in Ojibwe mythology and many cultures represents death and bad omens. And so when I did my sketch of this scene, these were all men and people who were the soldiers. But when I did the painting, they became predatory animals. And somebody asked me why that was, and at the time, I had to think about it later, and I thought, well, you know, I would just have to think to kill somebody would be a surreal experience. And so this fits that. I saw, when I was a student at U, I heard a little screaming, and I turned and I saw a crow pecking on a small bunny, and he killed it. But the red-winged blackbird, going back to the first image, is I went through my naming ceremony when I was about 38 years old, and my Indian name is a Siganak, which translates to red-winged blackbird. This is called Attack on Fort Snelling Bar and Grill. I was inspired by this painting. My wife Diane, who was researching history for her first book, became part of this organization who did this Dakota commemorative march every 2 years. And it's a lesser known piece of history about the elders, the women, children who were marched from Mankato to Fort Snelling during a November of a very brutal winter. And so, and then there's sentiment about Fort Snelling being a prisoner camp and thoughts about taking it down. And so that was my motivation for doing this painting. Lots of things going on in here. Over on the left, there's 2 Native Americans in the trunk of the police car. In 1994, the Minneapolis police arrested 3 inebriated Indians and put 2 of them in the trunk of the car. You know, and this is the same attitudes that exist today that were prevalent during the time of the 1862 uprising. What's that? Well, that cameraman is Edward Curtis again, and on the back of his vest it says 38 plus 2 more, And it represents, the day after Christmas in 1862, 38 Dakota warriors were hung in the largest mass execution in this country. And again, it's lesser known history that two more were extradited from Canada 3 years later and hung. And so in this composition, I have 38 people and two rabbits that represent those 40 warriors. Yes, in fact, this year is the 150th anniversary of the 1862 uprising. And so there will be many events surrounding this anniversary. There's going to be an exhibition at All My Relations Gallery in August. And I'm working on a painting that's 6 foot by 8 foot that's going to be about this event. And I don't know, normally I try to tone some of this sharpness down with some humor and metaphor, but this painting here is going to have a lot more bite to it. This is the last one. Last May, I was invited out to this organization in Pendleton, Oregon called Crow Shadow Art Institute, and it's a native-owned print shop. And so I went out for 2 weeks and worked with a master printer, and I made, about 75 prints. I stayed busy every day. And this is a mono print. I did 8 of them in this series. And I don't know if you can read it, but Tonto says, "You lied to me." Lone Ranger says, "Get used to it." So it turns out this is going to be another great vehicle for me to talk about things between cultures in a dialogue with Tonto and Lone Ranger. But also I wanted to say that this image is available as a poster in a t-shirt at Boakley Gallery. All right, let's eat.
I want to say a little bit about next month's symposium, because it's one, but it's a series, so it's symposia. It's a Latin ending, so it's not even my business. In any case, Tom of St. Cloud is going to be, he's a baker presenting on bread, and he does a lot of bread baking. He's at the Minneapolis Farmers Market and some other places. But his project right now that we like to support is he's going around the world at various nunneries and monasteries and learning baking techniques. So he came to us because he wanted to go to a monastery, and with some connections, I was able to get him into Mount Athos, which is like the Vatican of Greek Orthodoxy or Eastern Orthodoxy. So we're still working on a nunnery, so the Greeks among us, if you know anyone, you know, a nunnery that would accept an outsider filming bread baking techniques. It's a beautiful project and concept, and we're supporting him in that. So that's going to just segue right into our last course tonight, which is baklava. And I was happy to report that the baklava was found like 700 BCE, if you are PC. That's my latest mantra. But by the Assyrians, who basically, that's where wheat was formed. They did kind of a bread and nut and honey thing, but it was the Greeks who were the bread bakers of the antiquity and who consolidated all the forms that we know as caravella and boulange. They were doing that 500 and 400 BC. They were doing phyllo, so their contribution was the ultra-fine phyllo, which I attempted about 1 o'clock last night. So it's before the Turks. Thank you for pointing that out. I don't like to stomp on those points, but yes, this is actually right. Because I go to the Festival of Nations, we always have these competitions at the festival because I'm at the booth and the Turks are saying blah, 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 blah.
Why don't you translate for those of us who don't hear what you just said?
What? What did I just say?
Before the
Turks. The Turks, the Ottomans. We should say Ottomans. Before the Turks. There's a lot of consideration of where baklava was developed. But in any case, 500, 400 BC, the Greeks were doing it on phyllo with nuts and honey. So I did it last night, and because you may or may not have noticed, I was trying to kind of focus my menu tonight on American kind of food that became Greek, such as the rabbit and the turkey, because we all know the turkey is indigenous to northern North America, excuse me. I got an opportunity to buy black walnuts from Southeast Food Network. So these are hugely expensive and hugely fantastic, tasty. So that's when I said, I do the baklava. So it's baklava and fundukia, which is hazelnuts. Black sesame was known in Greek way back when, and it has different properties than the golden sesame. And we also have honey and 100% maple syrup. So that's all American. So I thought about a little honey, but it just seemed too sweet to me. So this is going to be 100% organic maple syrup as a syrup poured over it. I think the Greeks would appreciate it, the little addition I did for it. Yes, you all let me know, please. So in addition, we're going to pair it with a little ice cream, which is with the same nut mixture. But again, we're going to do the Mavro Daphne. So it's a little bit of sweet wine. So you have had the sweet Mavro Daphne wine in three of the four courses tonight. You had it in the beet soup. You had it in both of the meats, the lamb and the rabbit, if you were eating meat. And then now it's in the ice cream. So I try to do little tricks throughout the meal and connect things and try to, you know, show the variety of the Greek ingredients and how the Greeks use it. So let's see, there's a few more things I talked about next week. I want to thank Todd Buckley and the Buckley Gallery for bringing Jim Dunamy into our lives. That was fantastic, Jim.
I remember when I was emerging artist and I felt an expectation by a lot of people, both native and non-native, to do Indian art. And so when I was at the University of Minnesota, I started to research into contemporary native art because most people's definition of native art was focused more on a nostalgic stereotyping image of teepees and eagles and spirits and buffaloes and things. And, you know, growing up in South Minneapolis, we didn't see a lot of those things. So I started to research contemporary Native art, and in 1992, 93, I didn't find a lot published. But what I did find was artists like George Morrison, Frank Big Bear, who are both local here, and both of them became my heroes. And then, I can't remember what year it was, somewhere around 2000, the Wiseman Museum contacted me and said that they were going to do an exhibition of these watercolor paintings from New Mexico during the 1930s, and it was curated by the new University of New Mexico, and that they wanted to show a companion exhibit of local native artists, and they wanted me to be part of it along with several other artists. And I thought, wow, this is cool. And then shortly afterwards, University of New Mexico pulled the show out. And so the curators asked Todd if he could put together this show with George Morrison, Frank Big Bear, and Norval Morisso. Because Todd had pitched them that proposal earlier. And they said, well, can you put it together in 4 months? And so I got a letter from Lyndall King, the director of the Wiseman Museum, saying that this is just what happened. The New Mexico show was canceled, but they're going to do this great show with Norval and Frank and George Morrison. And I just thought, oh God, this is exciting. I thought, these are my heroes. And then further down the letter, it said that they were going to do a companion show of emerging native talent in Minnesota, and they said, unfortunately, we feel your work is too far progressed, and so they didn't want, I wasn't going to be part of this show, but she said, but personally, I want to invite you in to be part of a show that I'm curating the following year. And I exploded. I just crumpled this paper up, stomped on it, and then I was going to pick up the phone. I said, no, put it down. I had to wait 2 days before I could call Lyndall King and try to talk myself back into this show. And from the beginning, she was adamant, no, you can't be part of the show. And I said, wait a second, before you get any further, I said, let me tell you that when I started to research contemporary Native art and I found Frank and George and Norval, I said, these were my heroes. And I said, to be in a show that accompanies them would be like opening for the Rolling Stones. And she started to laugh, and she said, she said, now I see what you mean. She says, well, I'll talk to Kathy, the curator, but I can't promise anything. 2 days later, Kathy called me. She said, good news, Jim, you're back in the show. So I was part of this show. George Morrison, Frank Big Bear, and Norval Marisol were the main show. And me and Julie Buffalohead and Star Wallowing Bull, who was Frank's son, were part of this accompanying show. And it turned out to be a fantastic show. It was once in a lifetime grouping. And what else happened out of it was that the Wiseman ended up buying work from each of us. So it was one of my first museum collections. So that was a neat little story. This here is the seal, Minnesota State Seal. And I came across this image, about 5 years ago. It was about the time I was doing my daily painting thing, but it wasn't part of the daily painting project. And I just thought, well, this is really a historic, acharic, it's an old image that needs to be updated. And so I did a new sketch, and then I did a painting of it. Next. And this is, it was loosely about the Twins Stadium. For many years, the state legislations were after casino funds to help pay for a new Twin Stadium. And so I titled this painting, Show Me the Money. And this was just a start. I've done three paintings that just graduated from this show and became more complex each time. And down in the lower right, it was at the same time that the 35W bridge collapsed. So that's what that was. Next. So, and this is the latest out of three. It's directly. That is Jesse Ventura. That is their governor. He's holding a wad of money. He's got a fishing pole with a hand grenade on it. While he was in office, there was still litigation about the treaty rights, and the Ojibwe retained the right to hunt and fish and gather on ceded territory. And Jesse Ventura commented, he said, well, what about my right to fish with hand grenades? He says, when we were Navy SEALs in the Philippines, we used to throw hand grenades in the water and they'd explode and dead fish would float to the top. I said, what an idiot. So that's how he gained his perch in my painting. His love for money and fame was more important than anything else about Minnesota.
What's the three heads?
What's that?
The three heads.
The three heads, that represents Indian gangs in Minnesota, both urban and on reservations. There's a big problem with organized gangs.
What is with Paul Bunyan? Tell me what he's doing.
Oh, yeah.
What? I'm the white guy. I don't need to play like Native American.
That was just an inspiration. It was kind of like a Tourette syndrome kind of thing, you know?
Inspiration.
So, okay, and the little diner on the side?
That's the White Castle building. That's Fort Snelling from the other painting. That's about the Duluth lynching.
Yeah.
About 1919, three black men that were circus workers were falsely accused of rape and they were lynched. And it was found out later that they were innocent.
Yeah. And those two are still in the cop's car.
That's from the painting.
Yes.
What about the one tombstone?
About the what?
The one tombstone, what does it say?
Oh, that's the Red Lake school shooting. Out back in the back. The airplane coming down is Paul Wellstone's plane coming down for a crash.
Okay.
That's Norm Coleman. and it's Al Franken is doing a recount with the toilet paper. So this is all Minnesota history that I'm going to try to put on petition to have them make a new flag for half a minute. Yes. You know, most of this learned after I became more college educated, when I became more interested in political issues and history. And a lot of it is just kind of common knowledge that you know and you learn here and there.
But you're not naive because of your training. The paintings looks like kind of naive.
Yeah.
Choice.
Yes, it's a stylistic choice.
Yeah.
What is the pic to the left and the reflection from the state capitol? Is that like a trifoil? And what is the red pinny beam in the doorway? What is the color in the doorway?
It's a red doorway. It represents the Red Door Clinic.
Okay. And the shadow of the illumination coming out from the capitol?
What's that?
Or trifoil?
Yeah, it was just something that developed. I was curious about that myself.
And then the pit on the left?
On the left, that represents the 1854 Pine Tree Treaty, which the Ojibwe ceded most of the land in Wisconsin and Minnesota to the U.S. government, yet they retained the right to hunt and fish and gather on a ceded land in northern Minnesota and Wisconsin, which was the basis for the lawsuit against the state of Minnesota and Wisconsin for the tribes to continue fishing, spear fishing, and the hunting and gathering. And it was a right that the Ojibwe retained through treaty negotiations. And most people who don't understand this history, they believe that the Ojibwe were granted special rights to do so. In fact, it was the other way around, where the Europeans, the Euro-Americans were granted special rights. They got the land, the minerals, and the lumber, all the valuable stuff. But back then, when they were newly formed reservations, they were encouraged to stay on the reservations and not exercise these rights to wander about the ceded territory. In fact, if there was three Indians in a group, they were considered a war party. And so these rights laid dormant for 100 years, or almost 100 years, and then in the 1970s, there were two brothers from my reservation, the Tribble brothers, who contested these treaty rights. Well, they actually just went out and hunted and wanted to be arrested, and then it happened, and then they went to court, and they won. And they were very, very ugly protest in northern Wisconsin. And it came to Minnesota, and it wasn't nearly as ugly, but it was still kind of bad. So that's what that's about.
Can you talk more about what you mean by encouraged?
Well, they were encouraged to stay on the reservation, you know. All the land was being granted to incoming settlers.
Can you talk about the riverboat and the school bus?
Well, the school bus is the 35W bridge collapse again. There was a school bus that landed down on top of the wreck. The riverboat is the Dakota warriors who were convicted and not executed. They were transported down to Davenport, Iowa by boat.
Huh. Is that New Glenn Island?
It could be.
What about the two Indians behind the lake? It's a...
That's the spear fishing. It's like Grant Wood's American Gothic. They instead of the pitchfork, it's a spearing fork. And then there are sports fishermen in the boat fishing. And
what about the horses? Is that for Canterbury Park where Zoran lives?
Yeah, that's Canterbury Park.
That's my place.
And they're chasing the rabbit. They're interested in the casino money. Yes, it represents Perry Island, where there's and the nuclear waste is an issue. The federal government's been targeting native lands for 20 years to accept this nuclear waste temporarily while they figure out a long-term depository. And so in Prairie Island, they have these temporary waste caskets 100 yards from a daycare and school in the Prairie Island Reservation. Well, let's move on to the next one. This one's interesting too.
An easier one.
Yeah. Well, this painting is 7 foot tall by 12 foot long.
Wow.
It's called Eminent Domain, A Brief History of America.
Okay.
And for years, like 12, 15 years, I had a project in my mind to do a series of paintings called The History of the United States According to Jim Denamy. And what I envisioned was about four or five periods over time, beginning with contact, Indian Wars, and casinos and things, and probably 3 to 5 paintings in each period. And this one pretty much sums up that proposal.
Where is this one?
This one is at the Denver Art Museum at the moment. It was down in Santa Fe for a show last year at the Museum of Contemporary Native Art. So yeah, many, many, many things going on in here.
So talk about the conversation between Tonto and the Lone Ranger.
Well, again, that's you lied to me, get used to it. You know, it's treaty breaking and deception. Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, Bonnie Raitt, and Elvis. Yeah,
it's going in the hell there. I see the hell.
With our circle.
No, I said hell.
Oh, in the middle. It's a lava?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where?
Below the Mount Rushmore.
Oh, yeah. Right below Mount Rushmore is the Wounded Knee Massacre.
See, that is the hell.
So, yeah, I wish I had some details, but there's some... There's a Ku Klux Klan member up there and some monster-looking people. And there's a modern soldier in there that represents some of the massacres in My Lai and Vietnam. And
Paul Bunyan
made it back. Down in the lower right-hand corner, there's a guy coming out of the ground. And while I was working on this painting, the Chilean miners were rescued. And so, like I said, I always put something in that's happening around me. But yeah, there's lots and lots of things. One thing that happened that was unexpected, up there in the top, there's a church. There's a motorcycle flying over it. Well, that church is part of the boarding school system. In front, there's a pastor and a nun. She's holding a bunch of bananas, and the pastor is shoving a banana in one of these school children's mouth, and it speaks about the sexual abuse that was happening to Native children long before it became more what I call trendy in mainstream. And above that is Evel Knievel flying over to this church. And so I put Evel on his gas tank so people would know it was Evel Knievel, but it just put Evel over the top of this church, and I did not plan that. It happened.
Yeah, you have to fix this.
Yes, yes.
Is that Santa Claus up in the corner?
That's Santa Claus. It's my painting Irony.
Yeah. How about on the left? Way up the corner.
That comes from another painting. It's about the Bering Strait theory, where anthropologists believe that Native American ancestors migrated from Asia during the ice bridge theory. But there's been evidence of occupation here 10,000 years before that, and so it just shoots that theory to hell. My theory is that we were always here. We went to Asia for takeout and came back. So that picture, there's an Indian in a rickshaw holding a white takeout box. Which one?
Nude one. Top left. It was in many pictures.
End of the trail.
Mary Moreau.
End of the trail from the state seal.
Oh, yeah. Did she say nude woman?
Yeah, tell her it's a guy.
Oh, yeah, no, it's not a nude woman. It's just that scene, like, from the previous painting where Show Me the Money, the guy's mooning the farmer. So it's just... But now they're heading towards a casino sunrise more.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, there we go.
KQRS.
Yeah.
He is attached to KQRS.
Can you do the details on the other painting?
No.
There you go.
How do you move around?
I don't know.
Get closer. Oh, yeah.
It says, Indians, go home. Well, way in the very lower left is the Hawaiian Islands, and there's the Japanese plane coming in the Bomb Pearl Harbor. But this Japanese plane is made by Toyota. You remember the sticky gas pedals and...
Yes. I remember it well, so after me.
Still in lock, still in courts.
So how many more are you going to make this size painting?
Well, I am currently working on a painting for the 1862 uprising that's 6 foot by 8 foot. And I have decided now that I want to do at least 2 large-scale paintings a year for at least the next 10 years and maybe, you know, longer. The painting that I have made scheduled after the 1862 uprising, which is called Off the Reservation. The next one is going to be The Creative Oven. And in this painting, I have a split composition where the lower half is the reasonable world and the upper half is the dream world, the creative world. And down below there's an artist sticking his head in a gas oven, and around him is all the things of the reasonable world that distracts him or keeps him from putting his head up into the dream world, like a job and mowing the grass and paying your bills and all these little obligations. But he puts his head in the oven, cranks up the gas, and then his head pops up the smokestack. It goes through this macaroni and cheese membrane that's separating the two, and his head pops out of this volcano form into this fantastic land where there's just these beautiful colors and animals and things that have never been seen before. And he looks around, and there are other volcano forms and other heads sticking out, and people, there's other artists. They all go to the same place for their inspiration. Then there's this weird bird that's flying around, and he shits, and when it lands on your head, you're blessed with an inspiration. So that's going to be another big painting.
So you've had vision.
You know, sometimes they come, you know, years out. They start to build, and then sometimes they'll come as a title or something, a phrase. That's the Gulf of Mexico. That's the oil spill, the BP oil spill, Ku Klux Klan, bingo merchants, the first Indian casino opened up in Florida. So, and I have the battle scene from Iwo Jima on top. It's kind of a... Approximate locations, yes.
Approximate?
Yes.
So we have the towers on the
You have Bin Laden climbing up the Twin Towers as King Kong.
Okay. And then the Black Hills kind of in the Midwest there.
Yep. That's Custard being chased by, he's on a go-kart being chased by all these Indians.
Yeah, it's almost like TV. You can stay watching this all night.
Oh, you could stand in front of it for an hour and see something new.
Yeah. How long did it take you to do that one?
About 3 or 4 months. I had a deadline. I had to ship it down to Santa Fe last May, and so I probably would have continued working on it for a while longer. A traditional?
Ship it to Santa Fe for the traditional.
Yeah, no. It was at the Museum of Contemporary Native Arts, and it was an exhibit called Counting Coup, a national group exhibition. So there's Jack Kennedy's car. It's Jackie Onassis coming out after us. Jack Kennedy's head's blowing up. I don't know if you can pan down a little further, Todd. But they just, if you look all over, there are chickens and stumps all over the landscape.
And that's to show wherever Europeans colonized, they changed the landscape. And I've reduced it to chickens and stumps. But Jack Kennedy's car just ran over a chicken. And the car in front of him was supposed to be Governor Connally, but I got Abraham Lincoln riding up there.
Yeah.
And he's turning around to see what all the commotion is. Yes, it's just a comment on the environment, the abuses.
What's
that? That's the Oklahoma City bombing with Timothy McVeigh up on top and the Camp Davidian on flames.
What's the parade of people?
That's the Trail of Tears.
And on the covered wagon that was over on in the west?
Yes.
That
said Hooters. That was part of the California Gold Rush. Was San Francisco was built on prostitution.
Yes.
Oh, really? So I had the San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge, Patty Hearst holding a machine gun.
What are the clouds doing there?
Those are nuclear testing. No, it's open pit mining, uranium mining.
So Muhammad Ali beating somebody to the right.
Yes, that was his iconic pose where he's standing over Sonny Liston, but here I have him standing over racism.
That's what I'm saying. This looks like a
Civil War. Yeah, now on the left there is the image of Kent State, and I have it in conjunction with the Civil War. I see that as an act of Civil War too.
You have Mr. Adolf there too.
Yeah.
No, it's not Hitler.
Yeah, that's Hitler.
Yeah, well, I'm saying it's not.
He was part of the Wounded Knee Massacre or the Mindset. That's Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, Bonnie Raitt, and Elvis.
And Paul Bunyan is still screwing Blue Hawk.
He's still at it.
Next to the golf course.
Next to the golf course.
Why are Columbus
Columbus's three ships UPS truck?
Well, the Statue of Liberty is just, it says justice for all, but it's not true. And the three UPS trucks, it's just, I don't know. It's just more consumerism, or, you know, it just... They bought Attack on Fort Snelling Bar and Grill. They bought one of my Renegade paintings about alcoholism, my own personal experience and how I see it affecting culture, Native people. Let's see, they bought a couple prints. Well, they rotate. They've been up several times. And then Diane Mullen, I ran into her a few months ago. She's a curator there, and they told me about their plans to travel selections of their permanent collection to sites around the state of Minnesota now, and said that some of my work's going to be part of that show.
Yeah, does message feed art? Does message get in the way of art?
Message?
Yeah. Is politics art?
Are
they one and the same?
Well, it's subject matter, and that's how you interpret it, it's how you express it. That's what the art is. And I choose history because when I learn about some of this stuff, I'm fascinated and I'm kind of angry that I wasn't taught this earlier in life.
Yeah.
And I think other people should know about some of this stuff. And I like to present it in terms that invite people in, with the color, the humor, the irony. I don't intend to, you know, poke my thumb in people's eyes. I don't create any of the stories. It's all fact that I comment on. But what I talk about some of the mean things, but what I say is mean people suck, and the only people offended are mean people.
Was the earlier work we saw in the first slideshow tonight, would you call that political or not?
Some of it. The Renegade series was mostly political from a cultural viewpoint. You know, I think most of this comes from a cultural viewpoint. It comes from my viewpoint. You know, somebody told me that I was a spokesman for Native people, and I said, that's not true. I don't speak for Native people. I speak for me. Yeah. There's a lot of Native people who don't grasp this or embrace it, too. Talk to me. No, that's lots of books,
Books, or are there centers or the University of Minnesota? Somebody have to go to?
Well, even the University of Minnesota, you still have to do individual research. Yeah, well, Birch Park Books a good resource for historical. Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee was a book that just turned me upside down.
Yeah. Diane Wilson's Spirit Guard.
Well, and her second book, Beloved Child.
Which I haven't read yet.
Well, thank you. Thanks for coming. Thanks for...